Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022. Practical spirituality. Positive messages. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from a lovely day in Fort Worth, Texas. Everything's green right now. Gorgeous, not too hot. Today our topic is the work and legacy of the seminal spiritual teacher and author, of course, Paul Brunton, widely esteemed for creatively integrating the world's spiritual teachings and meditation systems into a clear, practical approach suited to contemporary Western life. New books gleaned from his copious writings continue to be published. He died in 1981, but they continue to be published. And one such is the focus of our study today, or our discussion today. It's entitled Instructions for Spiritual Living. And joining me to discuss that book and other topics of PBs, as he was called, Paul Brunton, is one of his longtime students, Jeff Cox. As well as being the editor of the aforementioned book, Jeff helped to build Wisdom's Goldenrod, a center for spiritual study led by Anthony Damiani, who is another student of Paul Brunton. Jeff was there for 5 years as a resident monk, and later he became a devotee of the Dalai Lama, and Jeff co-founded the esteemed publishing house Snow Lion Publications, a major public publisher of Tibetan Buddhist texts. I've got many of them myself in my library. He retired after nearly 30 years as president co-owner in 2012, and Jeff is a board member of the Paul Brunton Philosophic Foundation. So it's a true joy and pleasure to welcome Jeff Cox to today's show. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Paul. Thank you so much for the introduction, and I'm happy to be here with you.
You know, Paul Brunton led a storied life, didn't he? He's one of those great figures, a bit like Alan Watts, perhaps, you know, that came out of the 20th century, and whose legacy is still powerful today. And, you know, I read him years ago when I was first on the spiritual path, but then hadn't read anything until recently. So I was excited to get this new book, and it fulfilled my excitement because there's so much in this book. And, you know, Paul is erudite, but also accessible. And that's what makes it a delightful read. You know, he gives us the skinny on everything. And I you know, what I like about him is there's no pretense, is there? He is scrupulously authentic and honest in everything that he writes. And that's refreshing, because sometimes, you know, people have a little bit of an edge or whatever. There's no real edge to Paul Brunton. He's well known in some circles for introducing Meyer Barber and Ramana Maharshi to the West, writing a series of clearly argued, like I said, erudite yet accessible books, and many are still being produced today. And we'll talk a little bit about that too. So tell me a little bit about your personal experience with him and his teachings. You came across it fairly young in life, is that right?
Yes, I was in my early 20s, and I became interested in the mystical path, I guess, to make it brief. And I was encouraged to follow that by doing yoga and meditation. And the yoga teacher I had, I was asking a lot of questions, you know, about spirituality. And she said, you know, you really should read Paul Brunton. And I was living in Columbus, Ohio at the time. And it turned out that there was actually a Paul Brunton study group there that he wasn't leading. He was living in England. Or at that time in the late 60s, early 70s, he was already kind of semi-retired in Switzerland, where he lived out the rest of his life until he died in 1981. And I became part of this group, and we met, you know, weekly to read some of his books together and discuss them. And Anthony Damiani was a longtime student of Paul Brunton, had met him in New York City in the 1940s. And he continued to study his work and traveled to meet him occasionally in Europe. Well, Anthony was asked to come to Columbus and, you know, help lead some weekend seminars and so on. And I was so impressed with this person's understanding that I decided after I graduated from Ohio State University in whatever it was, 1971, to move to the Ithaca, New York area, which I've stayed ever since, and be part of a, you know, there was a study group here that Anthony Damiani had founded. It was in a bookstore that he was born and raised in New York City, and he acquired a lot of books on spirituality in the, you know, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and then he moved up here basically with his library. I think he opened a store with his library. Many of the books had his own signatures, you know, in them. Some of the older, you know, volumes that were harder to find and so on. Of course, he also carried many of the modern, you know, editions of various teachers. But anyway, he had classes in his store almost every night of the week. And then he would go off to work in a toll booth on the New York State freeway at the station of Waterloo Station. He says, I lost my ego at Waterloo, where, you know, Napoleon lost his ego. But anyway, we had these regular classes, and we eventually, he gave some of his land to a former not-for-profit called Wisdom's Goldenrod, you mentioned. And we built four buildings on that property over the next several years for study, meditation, retreat, and a library. What can I tell you about that? Why don't you ask me something further? Oh, I didn't tell you about Paul Brunton. Well, in the 70s, some of the people in our group were allowed, or let's say were invited by Paul Brunton to come to Switzerland and spend some time with him. And some of us spent more time than others. It just depended on kind of on partly on his needs, as he was getting to be an elderly gentleman. He had, you know, needed some help with his warehouse of sea trunks and other, you know, things that he had collected over his lifetime travel all over the world, meeting with spiritual teachers. And I went there twice, I guess, to see him for about a week each time, and got to just be kind of up close with him. It's one thing to go to a teaching on a weekend seminar or evening, or even like a retreat where you're with a lot of people in a, you know, in some setting. But it's another thing to actually be next to somebody who is considered a living sage and kind of experience oneself, I guess, in relation to that person. Because, you know, sometimes they say the more light, the more darkness appears within us. You know, we begin to see the nooks and crannies of how we're disfigured one way or another. We're not quite up to where we'd like to be, let's say. You know, we want to present ourselves to the holy person like we're something, you know, like at least a student and kind of on the way. But what I find around when you get close to people like this is that they help to show you your shortcomings, you know, the places that still need work. And that's what I meant by the more light, the more darkness. You get to see, and as one progresses on the spiritual path, I guess, the you know, greater depths of where one's resistance and where one's edges are that still need to be worked on and better understood, so that we can become vessels are aligned more with our deeper ideals and the values that we long to express in our life and to experience in our life.
I agree, and it's a bit like you're being confronted with a fearless gaze, isn't it? You know, and not just from the eyes, but from the whole being of the person. You know, you feel naked in their presence almost, like
exactly.
There's nothing you can hide from them. So that's disconcerting because it kind of you're used to being protected somewhat, you know, by your own humanness, your own ego, I guess, and these particular sages that are very, you know, wise could see right through that. But in my experience, you know, the true sage sees right through it, but it does it with compassion, right? They can be challenging at times, but they've got our highest interests, you know, at heart.
Exactly. You sort of said it when you said about his writing, that he sort of just tells it as it is without an agenda, as it were, other than to convey his understanding. Well, I think that's kind of what it is you get to see kind of through you're kind of given a glimpse of yourself through the eyes of a sage. And
right.
And it's done as an act of compassion. I mean, I don't ever remember him criticizing me, but I do remember on the second time I went to spend time with him that at some point, I felt like a tar baby, you know. I was just sort of trying to do certain tasks for him, and I could just feel my inner condition was getting a bit gnarly. And at some point, I just said to him, PB, I'm sorry, it's just the way I am. You know, it's like, what can I do? This is, like you said, he just sees you for what you are. It was like I was seeing myself for how I was in that moment. And, you know, he just kind of sat there like a kind grandfather looking at this 20-some-year-old, you know, like, well, you know, there's more to life. You'll go on or whatever. You'll get a chance to work on these things. But he didn't say anything. He just looked at me with those eyes the way you're describing. And 30 years later, I was reading some of his, you know, the posthumous writings that got published here in this 16-volume set called The Notebooks of Paul Brunton, which I could mention are available on the Paul Brunton website, the foundation website at paulbrunton.org. But I was reading through one night, and I came across this passage where he said, quoted me saying, it's just the way I am. But he added, shows somebody ready for the short path. And I know you've talked before about, you know, the long path of purification, you know, personality development, psychological growth, meditation, developing concentration, et cetera, and the short path, which is kind of taking hold of one's own divinity here and now, because it is present here and now. And I remember in your interview with the gentleman from the Texas Christian University a couple of weeks ago, there was something like that expressed, that I think it was said that enlightenment is already here. But I would add that I think in terms of Paul Brunton, he would say the real, the higher being, the divine ground is already present. You know, that's all, the soul is here. Our soul never abandoned us. It's been with us for this whole journey. But what does happen at some point is that we really come to recognize its presence. And eventually, what makes a sage is that we actually become that presence. It's an actual shift of orientation, a shift of identity.
Right.
So path is really taking that position on consciously. It's really starting to work with that consciously. Go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I was just musing about that. You know, sometimes I think we think there's a long path and we have to continue along it. And then eventually, maybe if we get it all right, they'll, you know, suddenly there'll be this opening or this breakthrough, this short moment of intense enlightenment or whatever you want to call it. But I think it's the other way around often. You know, we get insight, we get glimpses, and then we have to go on the long path to ground that, to you know, to make that real in our everyday life, in our humanness. And so, you know, they play with each other, don't they? It's not like, well, there's only the long path or there's only the short path. No, they are, you know, both and in our unfoldment, I think. There's times when, you know, I've had intense openings to that, you know, the perfection of the universe is one way to put it, I guess. You know, everything's fine, all is well, you know. Then, you know, you have to get back into the world of suffering. I'm a minister, so you have to deal with people on a weekly basis, you know, who are not feeling that. And you can't just say everything's perfect, you know, relax, because they're going to kick you down the stairs. You know, they want the compassionate touch of somebody that feels their sorrow and their sadness. And, you know, we have to go through all of that, I think. I think Brenton talks about that. Actually, I just ordered yesterday The Short Path to Enlightenment, because it intrigued me. And I read Adyashanti and comments on it, and he's one of my favorite modern teachers. So if he liked it, I know it's going to be a good book. So I definitely want to read that one too. I think Brenton talks about that, doesn't he? The fact that, you know, it's not one or the other, you know, you have to have both.
No, the way you said it, Paul, I would say was perfect from what I understand of Paul Brenton. You know, you clearly understand the life process. And even for the sage, whose identity maybe now, say, we could say is established in the what Adyashanti calls the divine ground, what Christians might call the Christ consciousness, and what Paul Brenton calls the overself, there's still growth. There's still the person, the vehicle, can still expand its ability for compassionate action, just the way what you were saying about, well, you're still in the world working with people and how to be skillful. Part of compassion is not just empathy, it's skillful means.
Yes.
The Tibetan Buddhists emphasize this a lot, the ability to understand another person so well that you know, because you've lived it, or you have the intuition now opened enough that you can actually guide the other person just by some simple gesture or word or whatever. It doesn't often take much, but to have that kind of openness requires that we be established in a deeper aspect of ourselves than the personality itself, which is undergoing all this change. So, you know, I think the long path by itself, it looks long and difficult, and you know, because I mean, how hard is it to give up smoking, let alone give up your ego?
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
well, so, yeah. The only downside to the long path is that it's forever. You know, we tend to put off our good because we're still perfecting ourselves. We're still working on. I've still got purification to do. I've still got this practice and that practice. And it could be an end in itself, almost, you know, that we're never going to get there. And I like the immediacy of, you know, certain sects of Tibetan Buddhism or this Satori experience of Zen or whatever, you know, the immediacy, what Adyashanti talks about as well. That immediacy is very attractive, you know, not to shortcut what we need to do, but just to get over it, you know, relax. It's all right. You know, you're already there. Yeah. There's a breath of fresh air to that, you know, that we don't always have to be struggling. Because I think the ego, unfortunately, can co-opt the spiritual path, can't it? And we can have this, you know, very nuanced, spiritualized ego, if we're not careful, you know, that's doing all the practices and, you know, is perfecting itself, you know. But that's a bit of a dead end, isn't it?
Well, that's what Chogyam Trungpa called spiritual materialism.
Right.
But, you know, it's more than just, say, dressing in Eastern clothes or wearing your mala or whatever, you know, your prayer beads. Paul Brenton puts it this way, you know, the final shift, you know, where one surrenders the ego and recognizes one's divine basis, one's divine ground, or realizes the overself to be one's true nature. These are all synonyms. It's not long before that step that one also finally is able to overcome and let go of fear, anger, and desire. I mean, if you think about it, Christ in the desert, Buddha under the Bodhi tree, why were these advanced beings harassed by, as it were, by, you know, these kinds of forces? And I think it points to, these forces, we could talk about what value they have in terms of our growth, but at the point where we're really trying to shift into one's own true nature, one has to give up the final threads or roots of self. And, you know, spiritual materialism has self in it. And I think why, you know, you and I are old enough that we've seen, you know, the comings and the fallings of various gurus.
Yeah.
And I think it's because, you know, beyond our personalities, beyond what we normally identify as our thinking, our emotional feeling life, our bodies, our kind of will, whether motivated by altruism or by self-centered desire or whatever, beyond the person, sometimes referred to as ego, but I'd like to reserve that differently, that term, there are layers of that are realizations beyond the finitude of person, you know, beyond the spatially located in the body kind of person, that these layers of realization, sort of like a Jacob's ladder, they are stations along the way, but you can fall from these stations. And that's what happens, I think, when we see these gurus take a dive, as it were, because of their, you know, longing for money or sex or power or whatever it is. These threads of anger, desire, and fear are still, you know, operative, but more subtle at those levels. The person may really believe, even maybe deluded, to think, well, I'm having sex with my students because it's good for them. You know, they're with a holy person and better me than, you know, somebody else, or you know, I need a certain amount of money, a lot of money, so that I can carry out the needs of my organization, or
right.
But absolutely, it's a lot for my own comfort. You know, however it is, you know, however you want to talk about it. But it's not until this, you know, the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, Jesus in the desert, it's not really until that stage when you're absolutely free from the negative sides of those forces.
Well, it's hard to fight adulation, you know. You get there's so many adoring devotees, you know, that just love everything you do, from the sublime to the ridiculous. You know, then you begin to fall under that spell. I think it's you know, it's hard to withstand. But you know, one of my favorite pieces in the, you know, the Buddha under the Bodhi tree was, you know, and it's all about separation. As long as we've got separation thinking, we give power to the other, right? And this, yeah, whole process in the desert is understanding there is no other, there is only the one. And then there's no fear, there's no sense of separation. But, you know, when Mara, the adverse ego, you know, sends the arrows of malice and fear and hurt or whatever towards the Buddha, you know, he has none of that left. All he sees is the oneness. And so the arrows are turned into flowering fronds, and they fall harmlessly to the ground. And I've always loved that image, because that to me is the way it works. You know, nothing can hurt us when we're not there. You know, we're no longer, yeah, an object to receive these things. We are the arrows. We are Mara. We are everything. You know, and it's so that he's defanged, if you like. He has no power, because the only power the adverse ego has is the power that we give to him anyway, right? So we're just withdrawing that power, basically.
Yes, but all along, you know, aside from us, you know, we're not going to compare ourselves with the Buddha or Jesus, but all along the path, all along the way, there are these tests, and PB has a chapter in this book called Probations and Tests of the Aspirant.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's kind of like the smoking example. You know, if you decide to give up smoking, and then sooner or later you will be in a situation where you just think, like, oh, if I really need to have a cigarette now, I just need one, you know, and you'll feel it as if it's you yourself having this, you know. It won't feel like it's coming from the outside the way Mara's arrows were at that point in the Buddha's life. But you will feel a test of your own resolve. And it's those tests, when they get to that point, when there's a kind of sense of urgency to do the thing that you would actually rather not do under the force of temptation or whatever. It's those points that are actually can be like pivotal points, because if you refrain from the cigarette, it's done. It's over. You know, a Buddha could touch the ground and say, the earth is my witness. I have, you know, none of this bothers me or affects me anymore. These forces of separation that you, I think, wisely said.
Well, and you know, go ahead. Sorry, finish the thought.
No, that's okay. I mean, this thing of, I've been thinking about it. You know, there's, as you mentioned in the recent interview, there are, in most systems of spirituality, there are ethical qualifications. But they usually say there's just ethics, you know, and some people might say, well, oh, that's just because society needs certain rules and other that we don't go around killing and still stealing from each other and so on. But the point is that the movements in us that are counter to our aspirations, that's I think a better way of thinking about ethics and character development. What are the movements within us that counter our aspirations? And PB emphasizes the need to regard ourselves as a detached truth seeker. So it's like, as we can develop a greater, well, the way we talked about before, the way the sage looks at you with compassion and but with clear seeing revelation of your nature, we learn to do that for ourselves. And start to say no to the little movements in us that really actually compromise us. We can start with the little ones, and eventually we get to some of the bigger ones.
Yeah,
like
that's very well put.
Under the Bodhi tree or whatever.
I hear the music arising, which means we're coming to the break. So let's listen to these messages from Unity, and we'll be back to talk more about Paul Brunton. I'm with Jeff Cox. Join us in a couple of minutes.
This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world, welcoming the LGBTQ community today and every day.
If you've been inspired by the programming on Unity Online Radio, we hope you will give your support so others may be inspired too. This online radio network depends on the support of listeners like you to continue operating and expand its outreach. Go to unityonlineradio.org and click on Donate today.
Here's a Unity Wisdom Moment with Eric Butterworth.
How much time is enough time? You ever thought about that? How much time is enough time? Time is not a quantity. It cannot really be measured. Oh, you say, but it can. I have a watch. But the watch is synthetic. There's no way to really measure time because time is a depth. It's an allness. You may say, but I only have an hour. I only have a day. And so all you do is admit to yourself and to others that you've encased yourself in a shell. And this time frame will always frustrate your creative flow. And time for you will be a matter of the clock ticking on. But it's only where you are in consciousness. So it's time to slow down, to look up, to get a sense of the eternal. And this basically is the purpose of prayer.
To hear more talks from Eric Butterworth, visit truthunity.net.
Time is running out on the early bird discount to travel with Unity to Rome and the Amalfi Coast next spring. You'll tour the countryside with guides to the history, the food, the Vatican, and of course, the Sistine Chapel. Explore charming villages and maybe enjoy some Italian wine. Space is limited for the tour group and it's filling fast. Register by September 15th for the discount. Go to unity.org/Rome2020.
Hi, this is Lisa Williams. I'm launching a brand new online course called Enhance Your Intuition, Unlocking the Power of Your Spiritual Senses. Join me for this transformational experience where you'll learn how to engage, enhance, and embrace your intuition on a whole new level. Plus, save 10% with the coupon code UNITY. Visit lisawilliams.com/intuition and register today.
Discover what your dreams are trying to tell you. Join dream expert, best-selling author, and hypnotherapist Kelly Sullivan Walden for Ask Dr. Dream every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Central. Kelly will awaken you to the wisdom of your dreaming mind with expert interpretation, as well as introduce you to fascinating guests. Each week, you'll get information you can use to help make decisions and gain greater self-awareness. Join the show live or listen later on demand here on unityonlineradio.org.
Call now with your question or comment. 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Jeff Cox, who's a student of Paul Brunton, and also the founder and publisher of Snow Lion Press, which is very influential. And we've been talking about the book that's by Brunton called Instructions for Spiritual Living, and had a wide-ranging discussion already. I want to cover some of the chapters that have some particularly interesting things from my point of view. And the one that I loved is about illusion. Is the world an illusion? Because I think in some ways we have this misunderstood idea of what illusion is in terms of Eastern philosophy. Like everything's an illusion, nothing's real. And Brunton says, well, not really, right? It's an emanation. The appearance of things has a relative reality. But it all ultimately comes from source, from mind, or whatever you want to call it. But to say, like some do, like Course in Miracles, for instance, seems to deny that there's any validity at all to materialism or to the manifestation. Whereas I personally think, you know, it has a certain reality that we don't want to deny. What's your feeling on that, Jeff?
Okay.
It's a big subject.
Yes, but I'm going to try to cut to the chase here if I can. I mean, when we believe in our separation, you know, when we're really bound in our I am the body kind of central view and the world is out there, that's generally what we would call materialism. You know, the world's out there and my body's in the world, but I have this subjective stance on it, and I can say that it's real in itself, in and of itself. Now, people that follow the mystic path, they can get to a place in their realization of the reality of consciousness that the world actually looks and feels sort of dreamlike. It kind of loses some of the juice that a good materialist would give it. You know, you want to go out there and grab all the gusto you can. Well, that usually means, you know, in sports cars or at the, you know, whatever, roller derby. I mean, I don't know, whatever people are into, they get their thrills that way.
Yeah.
You know, but the mystic gets its thrills. The mystic experiences are inner, you know, withdrawn from the sensible world. I mean, one of the first things one must do in the yogic system is withdraw from the senses. So the inner life becomes very enlivened and takes on the reality that we used to give to the world. But then the difference is that between the mystic and what Paul Brunton and others, but I mean, you mentioned Adyashanti before, I think he's really good, they emphasize that it's not the final step. And the final step is where one recognizes, as you mentioned, the world is an emanation of the inner reality. The Buddhists like to call it the void. It's a formless realm from which everything appears. It's like in the analogy in physics, I guess, is like the world is like the collapse of the what do they call it? The help me here. you know, the collapse of the formless possibilities that are in, you know, it's not Einsteinian relativity. It's the step beyond. What's the, you know, Schopenhauer and those guys.
Quantum physics,
quantum physics. Thank you very much. I just had a, I don't know if that was an ageism blip in my awareness.
It happens to us.
Quantum physics has this view, and it's a really good one, analogously, of a kind of a formless indeterminacy that when consciousness is present, the wave collapses and you see the world, as it were. So what we could say from the view of what PB calls philosophy, or let's say the view of the sage, beyond the view of the mystic, is that the world is the transformation of that void, of that formlessness, but it's not outside of it. It's like the waves, the old analogy, the waves and the water. You know, the waves are like the emanation. The water is obviously what remains when each wave lapses, or we could call, say, each moment of consciousness lapses back into that, the waterness, the formlessness, but it happens, the next moment happens so quickly that we don't normally notice this kind of transformation going on. So the actual appearance of the world is just as real as that void reality in the moment that it's happening. It's
right.
It's the now that they're always talking about, you know. Be in the now, because in the now moment, what you're getting is the divine, it's actually the divine revelation. It's the creation of the God's creation happening every moment. And I think Meister Eckhart referred to it this way too. It's this view that the world of experience is the divine creation every moment in time, or it's not in time, it creates time, but the appearance of the universe is like God's eyes and ears into the world.
Yes,
and we are part of that appearance, you know, that's in this moment, it's real. That's why we say, you know, get out of your dreams, come back to the real world, but you mean just present reality, you know.
Right.
Don't drift off into the past or thinking about the future. You know, all those things happen in the present anyway, right? But it's like be here now.
Right.
It is the place from, it's kind of like the launch pad from which you can, it's the launch pad from which you can recognize reality, is to really come present, to really be present. And it's a way inward into that reality is through the simple sense of presence, the simple sense of the inner silence that's already present here and now, but we just don't attend to it. Our awareness is actually the light. The light, which was the light of all men. You could probably quote the Bible better than I on that one. But so that light is our awareness. It's the light of God. It's so intimate when you think of it that way, is the very ground of knowing by which we know anything.
Right. Very, very good.
So is the world an illusion? Well, it is if you're a mystic focused inwardly, or a dreamer living in the dream, you know, one's own dreams or one's own, you know, subjective reality, to the extent that you just kind of lose touch. I mean, people are either mental or they're mystics, you know, from that point of view. And nor is the world exist on its own. It's not that we escape from it. It's how to better use it.
And
it isn't even really a question of using it, like we're going to, you know, get everything we can out of the earth or something. It's more like, how can our experience be fully the revelation through us, through our understanding, through our own individual abilities, that it's capable of being. It's like developing our intuitive, our ability for our persons, our finitehood, to respond to the intuitive force within us that is trying to, that enlivens and also tries to inform. You know, the soul brings order to the universe. the chaos that that was our personality at some point becomes ordered enough through character development, through all these kind of long path practices that we've been talking about. It becomes more like, the way another analogy I like is like, you have two guitars in a room. And if they're in tune, if a musician plucks one string on one guitar, the string on the other guitar will start to vibrate. The same string, right? If it's the D string or G string,
right,
or whatever. So, but if the other guitar is out of tune, sort of like an undeveloped personality, it's not going to respond. It's out of tune. So what we want is for the movements that come from deep within us to have a place to resonate within us so that the grace, we could call it the grace of God, can express in our lives and extend to others. So I think, I didn't know Course in Miracles took such a hard stand that way, but it totally devalues the whole reason for God's purpose, we could say, for having creation at all.
Right. Yeah, that's my view on it too. Yeah. Well, it reminds me of the old song by Donovan, back in the day, that old hippie musician. He was quoting from the East, and he said, first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is, and could say, what the heck does that mean? But it means exactly what you're saying. First, from a materialistic point of view, there's the mountain, and then you get into a sort of mystical dream state and there's no mountain. But as you ground your understanding, there's the mountain again, but it's not quite the same as the first mountain, right? It's seen in a more enlightened viewpoint, but it doesn't mean the mountain disappeared completely. That's the key,
Yes.
Yeah.
That experience you mentioned earlier of seeing the rightness of everything, seeing how everything is just perfect in the moment as it is. That's a glimpse. That's grace, that has come through and shown you. That's the way the enlightened ones see all the time.
Right.
That the world is perfect. It's PB in the Bible, it's referred to as the Word, and the Word made flesh in a way is God's intelligence, God's plan, we could call it plan or something, the way it embodies itself. PB calls that the world idea. His word for God is actually the world mind. He puts it in terms of some kind of greater intelligence.
Right.
And within the world mind is this unimaginable possibilities. I mean, if you look at the universe, it's just overwhelming. It's unimaginable. I mean, I think a galaxy, for instance, is as good a representation for the mind of God as anything. When you look at it, it's all these stars and planets revolving around a central core of light, and with a black hole in the middle, which we could also talk about, but won't. But you know what I'm saying? It's like there's this divine plan that's unfolding, and as long as we don't see it, then we just think there's a mountain. And once we withdraw, we begin to see, there is divinity, but it's not in the world. It's somewhere inside. But the final view is really, no, it's the intelligence that made the universe to be what it is perfectly capable of guiding you through your life experiences to become that resonant guitar that I was talking about before. And more than that, to become an identity in, your life orientation will be that of, I am the divine ground beyond any sense of separate self, and, able to follow those promptings and creative promptings out into the world of my experience. It's all about your experience and the quality of your experience.
There's a beautiful story about Miller Rapper, I think, that references this. I wish I could remember the whole thing. It's too long to quote, but basically Miller Rapper teaches these people to, meditate like the ocean, like the mountain, like, the vast sky, whatever. And this woman goes away and meditates, but she comes back. She says, I've meditated on the ocean, on the mountain, on the sky, but you know, I'm confused by all the plants growing on the mountain. Let's just use the mountain image, and you know, all the multiplicity of life. And Milarepa says, "Well, you've had a good meditation, but when you see all the plants and the animals on the mountain, that, you know, that's the fulsomeness of God. That's God's glory manifest through all the creatures and the flowers. And so rest in that. It's not a problem. In other words." I've always loved that because it's the integration, you know, of the mountain of strength and magnificence, but it also has all the details on it too, all the living forms, which are part and parcel of it. You know, they're not essential to it in the sense that they come and they go, but they are part of the majesty and joy of God, you know, endlessly expressing. So, you know, that sense of allowing both to be there is very beautiful for me.
Yes. Yeah, so there's something that's coming up as I hear you speak, and that's that, I mean, for one thing, Eastern doctrine talks about reincarnation, right? So these teachings are in the context of many lives to become the full being, the full product, let's say. Not that there's ever an end product, but to become, say, properly oriented, to know that one's inner peace is what one fundamentally is. It's not an experience, but it's one's own nature. A sage is grounded in peace, but there's always this experience going on. But the thing is, I've read this, you could have 100 sages in a room, and they won't agree necessarily on anything particularly, but they won't be disagreeable.
Yeah.
And what this means to me is that, and it points out, and PB talks a lot about the independent path. It talks about it in this book, especially in the chapter on the need for teachers.
Yes.
And it comes down to this, that each of us are a unique, do you see duplication anywhere? Are any two oak trees the same? Are any two human beings the same? We all have, because we all have our unique experience, and we could add over hundreds of lifetimes, we each become a kind of a unique representation of certain divine possibility. So it's like, I like to think of it as a huge diamond with infinite facets, and each facet becomes like a unique individual expression of divine possibility. And as those expressions come into their fullness, they each kind of become mirrors to the divine through the contact with others, through, you know, they just show forth the gifts they've been given. You know, your particular talents come to serve the community that you serve. And, you know, as we grow, we start to see this. You know, I wouldn't be able to help a certain group of people if I haven't had those experiences. But nobody has exactly the same experiences, and we each therefore need our own independent kind of path to discover our own uniqueness. So TB makes the point that a teacher should be like a midwife and help you to discover what you are truthfully, and not hold the student to the teacher. And, you know, PB never had a group, as far as I know. I mean, there were places he traveled where there were seekers that would come together when he came. But he was not, he used to say, I'm not a guru, I'm a researcher. I'm like, he's like exploring the world beyond worlds in a way. He's exploring the nature of reality and a lot of things, which we don't need to go into here. But he shared his discoveries in his writing, and he said, let the books be the teacher in a way.
Right.
That was one reason. I mean, he was even kind of, you know, in his latter years, he sort of fell out of being known in the general culture because he didn't want to be, he didn't want people to worship him the way people worship some gurus. He wanted people to discover their own inner PB, is the way he described it. Right, look at me. Find your own inner truth, you know.
Well, I think that's what makes him quite attractive. You know, I love Alan Watts too, but Alan Watts was sort of the opposite in that sense. You know, he was a very flamboyant man and who adored being adored, you know, and had a little mischievous aspect to him that you don't see in PP. You know, PP seems to be very self-deprecating in many ways, you know, and that's attractive. Plus, you know, my own path has come across many sages and gurus, but I've never felt like I follow a particular one. I admire many, but, you know, I agree with PP that, you know, ultimately, you know, you are your own guru, right? You're the only one that can really come to terms with this magnificence and this mystery and this whatever it is, this ball of wax that we live in. You know, you have to do it for yourself. And, you know, he points us in that direction. And it is a great chapter, the one you just referenced. But then I found every chapter had some particular thing. I want to go back to the one where you said that, you know, say you give up smoking, you know, or you say, I'll never be angry again. I think I understand why I'm angry. I don't need to be angry anymore. And then you find yourself in a screaming row with your wife, you know, just a few hours later. It's what that tells me is that the universe is very finely tuned. You know, if you put anything out there, it's going to respond, you know, and so that tells me that, you know, it is unbelievably, more amazing than we could imagine. For instance, if I was to just try and define my arm movement, you know, in a calculus, it would fill a book to describe what I did. And yet I'm, you know, there's millions of people doing all those things. So there's an infinity of complication, and yet it all happens gracefully in our, you know, in the world. It's allowed. God allows. And to me, that's endlessly boggling. You know, it's endlessly, you've got to raise your words of praise to this over self or whatever you want to call it, that can allow that to happen in such an amazing way. So,
yes, it shows that we're living in a sea of intelligence, actually.
Yeah.
When you mentioned about the anger thing, you know, it's like the divine so cares about what you really want. If you really want to give up anger, well, it has to show you what it's all about.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And how destructive it is.
I love it.
And it's going to show you right in your own life, or maybe you can learn from observing, reading the news or watching the news, you know, whatever, you know, but it's not about suppression. It's about deeply understanding, so that it's actually transformed.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's really, I think, at that level. And this, I actually find, you know, after whatever, 50 years of studying this material, not just PB, obviously, but that there could be such an intelligence, which we call God. You see it in lots of ways, you know, that there's the synchronicity of certain events and things, that there's, it's just too mind-boggling, you know, it's too real to just be coincidence or,
right.
You know,
right.
It just shows you how pervasive this, the guidance and that we're living kind of, well, Shakespeare said, you know, we're just the players, you know, God wrote the script, we're the players. And, what I want to say is that it just boggles my mind. I think, say, PB writes somewhere that the sage remains totally humble in the presence of God.
Yes.
And, you know, I think there's actually a confusion in some of the modern teachings that sort of equate the over-self or the divine ground that Ajah talks about, Ajah Shanti. There's a, what we're talking about, the ground of who we are, is what we could call the soul. PB calls it the over-self, but it is the life of God. It's the life. It's in Plato, you know, time is the moving image of eternity.
Okay, so what's eternity? Well, what I mentioned before about the world mind and the world idea, these exist. This is eternity. This is God in eternity. But the soul is God in motion. It's God realizing in eternity, God knows itself perfectly. It's eternal self-knowledge. But in manifestation is the process of God waking up to itself in and through form. And so when a person achieves sagehood, then that body of form, that person, that individual, individuated and developed on all kinds of levels within one, now becomes it knows divinity, and that is the soul knowing itself. And PB calls that insight. I don't know if I said this clearly enough, but insight is the soul, the universal soul that's present in the same soul that's present in you, present in me, present in an ant, a tree, whatever. Its total focus is on manifesting, on developing forms, and it's fully intelligent, fully capable of doing that. But it's self, what we call self-consciousness in the beginning is just sort of consciousness of ourself as separate from others and so on. But self-consciousness eventually develops into consciousness of self. And that's in the biggest term. So,
but I hate to stop you because of this.
Yeah,
is
I see the clock.
Stuff. We are
totally
out of time.
Maybe I got this point.
I know. Go ahead.
No, I'm done. I'll let you.
Yeah, no, it was a very valuable point. I'm sorry we have to break it up, but we're literally out of time. Let me tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye to Jeff. Next week, internationally recognized shamanic healer, teacher, and author Evelyn C. Ristic joins me to talk about the Nepalese shaman path. But thank you, Jeff, so much. I want to keep talking. I'll have to come back on the show soon.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Paul.
And thanks for listening, folks. We appreciate it. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IamDivine2022.